This is Our American Stories. Baseball is the topic of this segment. Spring training just ended, and the opening week of baseball is upon us. And we thought we'd look back at some of the highlights of spring training, and specifically, two teams who've had an interesting spring training, to say the least, the Chicago Cubs and the New York Mets. Two teams with a great shot to win it all this year. Joining us now to break down some of the buffoonery here is Nate Scott, a writer and senior editor of USA Today's sports site, For the Win, the best site in sports. Check it out at ftw.usatoday.com. His team at For the Win has been calling this strange series of events the Great American Loose-Off. Nate, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Nate, what do you mean by this title, the Great American Loose-Off?
Well, you know, every year there seems to be a team or two in Major League Baseball that is trying to compete to have the loosest clubhouse, the guys who are having the most fun, the team that is just having that great time. And this year there was an arms race with this loose-off, and it came down to the Cubs and the Mets, with each team seeming to compete to who just has that loosest team in baseball honor.
Well, that's something, I got to tell you. And by the way, I would assume the reason to do this is to get unit cohesion. It's a long season, and if guys can have fun together, well, then maybe they withstand some of those droughts you inevitably have in baseball. Let's start with the Cubs, Nate. Joe Maddon is the manager. Talk about a few of the gags, goof-offs, just silly stuff that they're doing to unite the boys.
Well, it started simple enough. It started with just a dance circle at spring training. That was all well and good. They played some music. Everyone got in and danced. But then quickly, Maddon said he was gonna up the ante. We had clowns at spring training. We had a player performing live electric guitar. They brought in a mime to lead stretching, an actual mime in makeup. And it all came to a head with the Cubs bringing out actual bear cubs from the zoo, were brought to the field and playing with the guys on the field. So they brought in wildlife by the end of the thing.
Oh, that's great. When you're really in the ditch, you always bring out the animals, Nate. Always bring out the animals. I heard that Anthony Rizzo had a little run-in with one of these little bear cubs. Talk about that.
Yeah, Rizzo, you know, decided to get in there. He made some friends. He's holding the bear cubs. And then, of course, almost instantaneously, one of the bears relieved himself on the slugger. So, you know, this comes with its risks.
Oh, it does. I'll talk about the dress code that Maddon talked about for a bit, because I think he had some feelings about, you know, I often see these players dressed in these suits, getting on a plane, getting off a plane, and I mean real expensive suits, the Brioni kinds, and I'm thinking, what's that about? Talk about the whole idea of a dress code and what Joe Maddon thinks about it.
Well, you know, there is this running theme in baseball right now that there should be respect for the game, and players should act like professionals because this is a professional environment. Of course, Joe Maddon realizes how silly this all is because they make the managers wear the little pinstripe suits and sliding pants with it. And so he has done away with dress codes. The Cubs' official dress code is, and Maddon gives the quote here, if you think you look hot, wear it.
I love
it. And that is the Cubs' official dress code for the 2016 season.
And Nate, thanks for that, because that's now the official Our American Stories website and studio protocol. If you think you're hot, wear it. I appreciate that. I'm coming into my thong tomorrow. Quick question here, Nate, before I know the guy's just about hurled there, Nate. the Mets, by the way, are at it too. What are they trying to do to one-up the Cubbies?
Well, it's really all led by Yoenis Cespedes, who is their Cuban power-hitting slugger. He agreed to come back to the team this year. Not everyone thought he would be back with the team, but he has come back and he has made this team his own. He kicked off spring training by, I think he might have been late for the first day, or this was the day before spring training started. He went to a fair and bought the prize-winning pig there for $7,000.
That's lovely.
And bought the pig, made a big deal about the pig. Everyone was so happy, and then he immediately sent it to the butcher to feed the team. And so that was how he kicked off the Mets season, by bringing them the meat from a $7,000 pig.
Oh, and I'm sure the folks over at PETA just love that, huh?
Yeah. That was a twist that I don't know everyone thought that saw it coming, but I mean, that's how he did it when he was back at home, and that's how he's going to do it here.
Well, that's true. And by the way, the people at PETA probably don't like the number one food being served up at baseball stadiums around the country either, and that'd be the good old fashioned hot dog. Nate, who do you personally think, and your team over at USA Today think, is the actual winner of this, what you call loose off?
You know, Cespedes has been wonderful, but this belongs to the Cubs. It starts with the manager. He sets the tone, and the rest of the guys. If you give a bunch of 20 and the 25-year-olds an excuse to be goofy, they're going to seize that opportunity. And Madden has given them free reign. This is a team that there are props, there are costumes, there is music, there are soundtracks. This is a team that's just having fun. So I'm giving it to Chicago Cubs. So if that's any sign of anything to come, put some money down on the Cubbies. This could be their year.
You got it. Maybe we should have a morning line on this every year and bet on this every year, Nate. We appreciate what you're doing over there. That's FTW.USAtoday.com for the win. The USA Today guys just having some fun. Check out the website. Nate, let's make you a regular here on Our American Stories. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks so much.
You got it. This is Lee Habib, and we like to have fun here. My goodness, I want to go over there and play with these guys next spring training. And we should come up with some gags of our own, guys. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. If you want to catch all that we do here, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. More after this.
Yeah.
Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And as often as possible, we like to have Jesse do his version of the news. And today's subject and through line is cats.
Pop singer Miley Cyrus is nursing her wounds after she was injured by a vicious cat. Miley shared a photo of her forehead injuries with fans on Instagram, adding a caption of expletives. Cyrus shared two other pictures, including a close-up image of her bloodied scalp and a picture of a deep, long laceration on her tattooed forearm. The former Hannah Montana actor has been an animal advocate for many years, and she recently backed a campaign to end the hunting of lions in South Africa. Got rats? Hundreds of cats are being hired and put to work in local homes and businesses in Chicago. There's a waiting list for the cats, and a lot of the people that are on that list live near the soon-to-be-demolished buildings like the Children's Memorial Hospital in Lincoln Park. When the building comes down, the rat problem is expected to get worse. The street cats were scheduled to be euthanized, but then rescued from animal shelters and sent into places like businesses, factories, and homes to kill the rats.
All right, now, where were we?
I'm sorry, are you saying meow?
Am I saying meow?
A woman in California has transformed her 4,000-square-foot home into what's believed to be the largest no-cage cat sanctuary and adoption center in the United States.
If I didn't have to deal with all the humans and the drama in life, I would be just perfectly content just taking care of cats.
An estimated 24,000 cats have been saved by the sanctuary, which houses up to 1,000 cats at any given time. 67-year-old Linnae Latanzio set up the cat house in 19... 19- 1992 after finding out that many nearby shelters euthanize the cats who aren't adopted.
It just kept growing. I figured as long as I could take care of them and I had room, then I was doing a good thing.
As more and more feral and abandoned cats took up residence in her home, she moved out of the main house and into a trailer on her 12-acre property. Ladanzio spent her entire retirement fund on the pet project, which also relies on donations.
Don't fake, boy. Man, do you know how fast you were going?
She meow has a staff and a team of volunteers to help keep the house clean and the about 800 cats and 300 kittens fed. The sanctuary also employs veterinarians who keep the cats healthy and spayed or neutered. The cats eat about 1,000 cans of cat food every week.
Oh, my goodness.
For our American... Ow! I'm Jesse Edwards.
Now, what is so damn funny?
Oh. I can swear you said meow.
Great job on that, Jesse. Great job on that. And we hit every kind of subject here on Our American Stories. We covered Justice Scalia's funeral. And we're going to cover Merle Haggard. And right now, we want to hit cuddling. Because, well, we read a story in the Wall Street Journal, need a cuddle, hire a pro. And so we would track down a cuddler because we wanted to know what is this business. And, well, where do you start? And Kira Cuddles joins us now. Kira, thanks for joining us. Kira, hello, Kira. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hey, tell us this, Kira. You're a professional cuddler. Tell me what that entails. Like, you know, this has been a fascination for us for a couple of months since we read the article. And what led you to that? And what are your customers like? Talk a little bit about this space called the cuddling industry or the nascent cuddling industry. Talk about that.
So, what led me to it was that I had a lot of friends who messaged me and told me that I should apply for this amazing job as a cuddler because within my community of people, I already was very affectionate. And so, I applied to the job and I contacted Sam, the woman who created it, about a year before it all actually came to fruition. And me and her played tag on Facebook for a long time. And then, she had over 900 applications. Wow. And then it went down to 5 people and she had to decide on 2 people. And so, by then I was going to get a master's in nutrition and I didn't think that I was going to be able to devote my time and energy to it and thought, oh no, should I bail? And I thought, no, it'll all work out.
Well, it did.
Yeah. And then it worked out and she chose 3 of us instead and hourly wise, it all worked out.
That's fantastic.
And the clientele that we get is, are people who are depressed, autistic, cerebral palsy, have been physically abused in the past, or have a partner who hit menopause and doesn't want to be touched anymore, mm-hmm. or you name it. There's a wide array of people that come to us for different reasons, and they come and we just hold space for them and we present them with non-judgment and really allow them to feel safe and secure, kind of like when you're a kid and you want to be an astronaut and no adult around you says, no, you can't be an astronaut. Everybody says, yeah, you can be an astronaut. You can be whatever you want. And that's what we're there for, is we just let people be whoever they are. And don't tell them that they should be or shouldn't be something or someone, and just let them process through what they're dealing with. And so a lot of it is talk therapy as well, because the moment you are in somebody's arms, the oxytocin starts flowing, and so you become comfortable with them. And so it's touch therapy. And so we get, I guess, people I would say people would open up to us differently than they would just a typical psychiatrist or therapist,
because that oxytocin is flowing. That makes sense. Tell me this, first, two quick questions, and we got about 3 minutes left together. Do you have more male customers or female customers, and the cuddlers themselves? Are there more male cuddlers, that is the people who are hired, or female cuddlers? Talk about both sides, if you could.
We have more male clients. We do have, 20% female clients. And then for the cuddlers that we currently have on, we have four females and one male.
Right. I would assume this has a lot to do with either loneliness or just some contact. And I have some friends in equine therapy, and it's very much the same thing. People just want to get on the horse, ride the horse, play with the horse. And something to me sounds like this is a little akin to that in terms of this is a place where someone can just share basic feelings. Is that what's going on here, Kira?
Absolutely. I mean, what it comes down to is we all want to feel love. And so these people have come to acknowledge that they are missing that in their life some way or another. And so they come to us just to feel loved and accepted in life.
Well, that's great.
And that's what we hold place for them.
Tell us this, your best story. You got about a minute. Your best story is a professional cuddler. Let's hear it.
Ooh. Two. One, I walked into a place and this guy had just found out that he had been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And before we even went into the room, he said, "You are my hero. Thank you so much." And the other one was I had a young woman who was a stripper and was in that mode of life because she had had a lot of family disruptions in the beginning. And by the time she left, she said she could see how she was perfect and that everyone else was and that it was all going to be okay.
Well, Kira, this is what I'd love to do. When I'm out in your neck of the woods, I want to come over and I want to be cuddled, A. And B, I want to cuddle. I want to see what this looks like. And my guys here are sort of laughing, but I'm serious. I'm going to come over because I think you're actually onto something. And when you said the word love the way you did, and I can tell you this, I see a lot of loneliness in the world, Kira, right now. I don't think Facebook brings people closer together. I think it brings them further apart, so on and so forth. So what I'd love to do is take you on. Let's stay in touch. When I'm in your neck of the woods, I say, A, I want to be a customer. And then B, I want to see what it's like to actually be on the other side taking care of somebody, one or two people. I'm not sure I can cuddle a guy, though, Kira. And I'm just not sure about that. But I'm going to try. Maybe I have to try.
Well, you're welcome anytime. And we have over 50 different poses to introduce you to.
Do I have to practice up? Do I have to study? Is there anything I need to know, Kira? Like, do I have to do some yoga first? Or I just come in and just give it a wing?
No, we accept everybody exactly where they are.
Oh, I love that. Kira Kettles, thank you so much for joining us. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And we try to cover it all. And we saw this story in the Wall Street Journal, and we were just curious. And when we come back, a little bit more serious side, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we like to get behind a book every once in a while, dig into about a half dozen a year, and really get behind them, really dig in deep with the author. And our book that we're covering right now is Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. And the writer of that book joins us now, Greg Ipp, the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. And Greg, thanks again for doing this with us.
Lee, it's great to be on your show.
Well, I know this is your favorite chapter, and I think all writers have favorite chapters, even if they don't want to admit it, and you had alluded to that earlier with us. And this book, Chapter 7, is called Good Risk, Bad Risk, Balancing Safety with Disaster. Greg, let's start by reading from the beginning of the chapter. You write, quote, "We have to ask how much safer we want the world to be. This sounds like a ridiculous question. As safe as possible, right?" Greg, expand on that question and why you're even asking it.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because especially after the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, risk kind of got a bad name. We all feel that we're poor because a lot of people took some crazy risks. But the fact of the matter is, and I think this is intuitive, is that like taking risk is actually fundamental to human advancement, in some sense, human happiness, and that at some level, we're actually all better off when some of us take some risks. And there's not really an easy way to figure out at the beginning whether taking those risks is a good idea or a bad idea. So let me indulge me for a moment as I describe an interesting series of medical experiments that were done that demonstrate this. Now, it took place in Iowa, where some scientists studied the attitudes towards risk of some people that had damage to the part of the brain that controls their emotions and their sense of fear. And these people were asked to play a game, essentially, a card game. And some of the card games were designed to lose money. And so the longer they played, the more money they lost. And then they had people who didn't have this brain problem play the game. So the first group of people kept playing until they lost a lot of money. The second group of people stopped playing when they realized they were losing money because their brains were stopping them from doing it. So the lesson seemed to be clear. Well, you know, fear is important, right? It protects us. It keeps us safe. But then a couple of other scientists came along and said, no, that's actually the wrong lesson to take from this experiment. And they changed it a little bit. They had the same types of people play another game, but this time the game was fixed so that the longer you played it, the more money you made. So this time, once again, the people who had normal brains were playing this game. When they started to lose money, they stopped playing. But the people who had the problem with their brains kept on playing, and they ended up making more money because they didn't feel the sense of fear that came from losing money. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that fear keeps us from taking risks that can be bad for us, but it also stops us from taking risks that can be good for us. And the problem for us as a society is we don't know starting out which is good and which is bad. So we have to accept the fact that we're going to take some bad risks that end up badly for us, because in the end, it's probably a good thing for society.
Yep, and it's a two-edged sword, as you say in the book, Greg, in the end. And you're right. Everyone's a Monday morning quarterback. But how do you know until you do it? I want to read again from your book. You write, quote, "Most new businesses fail within the first 5 years. Thus, based on dispassionate appraisal of the odds, most people would be better off going to work for a big company than to start a small one. So why do some people do it anyway? Partly, it's their nature." Expand on that, Greg.
Well, when you actually do surveys of people who become entrepreneurs and you ask them questions like, how many Americans die of heart attacks per year, they will answer these questions with a high degree of conviction about their own answer. When you ask somebody who isn't an entrepreneur those same questions, they're not more right or wrong, but they tend to express less confidence in their answers. What does this tell us? It tells us that the people who end up starting businesses tend to have more confidence. Sometimes they often have overconfidence. And look, anybody who's ever watched like their favorite football team or basketball team blow a lead because they took too many chances, you know that overconfidence can be a problem. But on the other hand, if some people weren't overconfident, we'd have fewer people starting businesses. I mean, if you read interviews with people who started companies, like, you know, whether it's Walmart or Facebook or whatever, you sometimes, or the guy who started Uber, you sometimes like wonder, well, what's it like to be around this person? He sounds so overconfident, you know what I mean? It must be difficult to be around him.
Right.
But that kind of attitude, you sort of need it to overcome all the barriers that stand in your way to success. A lot of those people are going to end up losing a lot of money, but some of them are going to end up starting really successful businesses.
And, you know, something's happened in the last couple of years, Greg. More businesses are dying than are being born. And is that in some respect attributable to the fact that maybe we're conditioning our people to take less risks? How much of that is the economy, and how much of that just might be our, as parents, how we fuel the appetite for risk-taking?
It's hard to say, but you're definitely right that there seems to be a lot fewer people taking risks out there. There are more businesses dying than there are new businesses being born. There's fewer people striking out on their own to start new businesses. Young people are staying, living with their parents for longer. And I think this might be partly cultural, as you said. Maybe we as parents are teaching our kids the wrong lessons. But I don't think that's the main thing. Maybe it's because, as we talked about in an earlier show, that people are getting older. Older people don't take chances. I think that we may have let the pendulum swing too far from too much risk-taking to too little risk-taking after the last financial crisis. It used to be that a lot of people that wanted to try something new would take out a loan on their credit card, or they would take out a second mortgage on their house. It's harder to do both those things because of the new rules that banks have to live with since the last financial crisis. I would love for us as a society to find ways to encourage people to take risks. One of the ways might be to create safety nets so that when people fail at these new businesses, they don't end up destitute. So in its own way, the Affordable Care Act that Barack Obama brought in six or seven years ago fulfills that purpose. If people don't worry about losing all their health care because their business failed, maybe they're more likely to try that.
I think that's a fair point. And getting back to the financial crisis, since 2008, almost everyone has decided we must do whatever it takes to avoid having another financial crisis. You argue this isn't necessarily a good idea. Why is that, Greg?
Yeah, I don't think it is the right thing because essentially, let me give you an example. I'll look at two countries, Thailand and India, and these two countries had very different attitudes towards finance and investment and risk. India has had traditionally a very repressed economy where banks weren't allowed to lend against to a lot of types of companies. They were sort of forced to actually lend to the government. They were very restrictive on foreign investment. And India sort of grew at a slow but steady pace throughout the 80s and 90s. Now, you compare that to Thailand, and Thailand had much looser regulations around its banks. They were much more welcoming to foreign investment. And the Thai economy grew very rapidly in the 80s and 90s, but it also had, you know, a monstrous, devastating financial crisis in 1997. But if you actually look back from a few years later, the year 2005, you look back on which of these countries ended up better off. Well, the surprising thing is that even though Thailand had had this crisis, they still ended up having grown faster over that period than India did. And the point I'm trying to make here that sometimes you need to accept that risk of a crisis in order to allow the sort of risk-taking to take place that ends up enabling your economy to grow quickly over time.
Is the desire, though, to avoid that kind of pain mitigate, in the end, risk-taking? I mean, do people remember pain more than pleasure in the end, Greg? Is that what's really going on?
In the short term, they certainly do. I mean, they used to talk about depression babies, people who were raised in the depression who still refused to put very much money into the stock market. So there's no question that recent memory of pain is going to affect our attitudes for a long time. And who knows, maybe that's part of the reason why things are a little bit, why risk-taking isn't as prevalent as we'd like it to be. But before I go too far in that direction, it's not that there's no risk-taking. In fact, I would argue that until a little while ago, there was too much risk-taking in things like junk bonds and maybe lending too much money to shale oil companies. So I think it's a question of balance. It's a question of not shooting ourselves in the foot as a society by being so restrictive on our financing rules that we make it impossible for a lot of the future, you know, Walmarts and Microsofts of the world to get started.
You bet. And we're talking with Greg Ipp, his book, Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Greg, thanks as always for joining us and look forward to the next few rounds.
Lee, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
You bet. More folks after this. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We want to dig down into a story that we think you'll be interested in. And now and then, we dig into some policy debates in this country, but not through the angle of the actual policy itself, but where the policy actually hits the pavement and affects real-life human beings, real-life Americans. You've been hearing our series called Where Have You Gone, George Bailey? The War on Small Banks, and hearing directly from community bankers who've been forced to sell their banks to larger banks and even forced to sue their own government because of all the laws and restrictions and paperwork burdens that have been imposed on them by the regulatory burdens of Dodd-Frank, a bill you may have heard about back in 2008 and 9 that just sounded like some random bill, but it's actually affecting real-life people. Today we hear from a bank customer, or at least someone who tried to be a bank customer, Pat Keough. And we are also joined by Kyle Hopman, a reform leader with the Main Street Growth Project, who brought us this story. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Good to talk with you.
You bet. You know, Pat, I want to start with you, and Kyle will weigh in later on the policy, but we want to hear the story first. And what I'd like to ask you is, if you could, tell us a bit about your childhood, if you could, Pat, and who you are and where you're from. Just give us a minute or two. And don't worry about the dog. We love barking dogs, so it's good.
Well, I was born and raised in the Bronx a lot of years ago, and I went through college there, graduate of Manhattan College in the Bronx. And from there, I moved to Washington to attend Georgetown Law School at night. Well, I took a job during the day with the government, the United States General Services Administration.
Yep.
So from the Bronx to Washington, my parents were immigrants from Ireland, you know, came here with nothing, sort of the classic story.
And, you know, by the way, I hear the accent still, once in the Bronx, always in the Bronx, and Arthur Avenue may be one of my favorite places to grab any kind of Italian food. And so kudos to that neighborhood. My brother went to Fordham, and so I love the Bronx. I grew up in northern New Jersey, Pat. I want to talk to you.
How about that?
Isn't that, it's a small world. I want to talk to you about how you got to us. And that is, here you are, a guy who's retired. You've got lots of, well, not lots like you're some multi-gazillionaire, but you've got some investment properties. And you're going to get a mortgage, and, well, something happens. Walk us through that story of what happened to you, a guy with a solid retirement income, a guy with lots of property, really good credit. You haven't missed a payment on any of your rentals, any of your mortgages, from what I assume is just your entire life. And yet everything changes.
That's right.
Talk about that with us.
That's right. We were living at the time in Florida. We had family in Austin, Texas. We also had a second home, Alex, in Austin for some time. And we decided, you know, with the grandchildren here and all, to move more permanently to Austin. So we sold our home in Florida, and we sold our condo in Austin, which had doubled in the 5 or 6 years we owned it. And we bought a house in Austin with the money. We had anticipated taking out a loan on the new place in Austin. We sold the condo in Austin subject to a mortgage. There was a senior citizen that bought the place. She was planning to get a mortgage. And we had the cash from the house in Florida. We planned to use the cash from the house in Austin. We had other cash. She couldn't get a loan within the time needed, the person who bought the condo. And so we ended up applying for a loan on ours. And under the terms of the contract, we had a 45-day period to get the loan.
Right.
And during those 45 days, we went through the due diligence process with no fewer than 6 financial institutions, 2 credit unions, 2 national banks, and 2 community banks. And given the amount of paperwork and all the trouble involved, we simply couldn't get the mortgage in that time to meet our obligation. So in the end, we had to pay cash for it. We had the cash available. The banks could see that we had the cash available, but it still didn't matter. And we were only looking for a loan, Alex, that was going to result in 40% of the purchase price. So 40 LTV, as they say in the business.
Yep.
And we couldn't get a mortgage during the time allowed.
And then it's a pretty remarkable thing, because here you have what every bank you would think values most. and that's cash down and enough cash in reserve. And clearly, a character, your character is such, and it's revealed through our credit, that you're a guy who will pay his debt. And it, meanwhile, the bank's looking for like a W-2, which means, well, you got a job. But, well, anything can happen in a job. You can get fired. You can get your pay cut. You can get in an accident. And so what were the reasons they gave you for not giving you that line of credit, that loan that you wanted? I can only assume, Pat, that we're talking about a lot of seniors in the same place you are, right?
I think so, because if you think about it, you know, we did everything you're sort of advised to do. We, you know, we worked for a lifetime. We saved our money. We invested it wisely. So we have plenty of assets. We had plenty of income coming in from assets. But what the process now revolves around your last 2 years' tax returns. And on those tax returns, they really want to see W-2 income, employee income. But when they see assets, even though the income is substantial and more than enough to support the loan, they put the worst face on it. They presume, you know, in the case of stocks and bonds, that the market could go down 50% or more.
Right.
Or that, you know, in the case of your rental properties, that the rents could be discontinued. And, you know, everything is presumed not to work. But in the case of a W-2 employee, you know, presumably his employment is presumed to be perpetual or something.
Right.
And I kept on telling him, I said, you know, my assets can't fire me,
right,
but an employer could. But it just didn't seem to make any sense to them.
It's so true. And we also know that, let's face it, you know, the very loan that banks are giving to, that is to secure a home, that home itself can decline in value by half. Heck, we saw that happen in 2008 and 2009. So forget the W-2. The risk of the asset, that salary and all that paperwork is securing, I'd want to give money to a guy like you because you have cash to cover the cash. You've done everything right. I think I want to just bring in Kyle right now because, Kyle, you're the expert in this space, and I know you've heard all kinds of stories about the impact of Dodd-Frank on ordinary folks. We did a whole series talking to small bankers about how they couldn't afford the paperwork and they had to sell their banks. And by the way, Kyle, when they sold their banks, they didn't get the money they could have gotten because the banks weren't as worth as much because they weren't making a profit. And so talk about what's going on here and why is Pat and probably so many people like him having a hard time with banks. I think we lost Kyle. You there? All right. Well, we.
Oh, hey there, guys.
Hey,
sorry.
Kyle. No
I'm
worries.
Back. Sorry.
No worries.
No, I sorry. I put it on mute for a second.
No, anyway, no worry. You know what? Kyle. We're a night show, and we insist on barking dogs and a beverage or a cocktail. So if you were mixing a good martini,
oh, okay,
we are good with that.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, but go ahead. Shoot.
That's right.
Chime
so,
in.
Absolutely. So I'm so glad somebody poured me Patrick's story. And you guys are right. He did everything right. Now, this is America. It's very easy to spend money. Patrick didn't. He invested his money. Right? And I think we all agree, after the crisis, there were ridiculous mortgages being given, 2005, 2006, 2007. And the government came in and said, you know what? We have to do something about this. Right? There's ridiculous mortgages. And I think we all agree on that. Now, what they did was, it's a very D.C. thing. They wrote it, you know, saying you have to have a certain income and all this, and it doesn't sound bad, right?
Right.
But as Patrick said, W-2 is a job. And let me ask you this. If you were going to give a loan, would you rather a guy had an extra $20,000 in income because he bartended at night, right, and had $20,000, you know, from that? Or would you rather a guy had $1 million in investment that got 2% interest off it? Right.
Yep.
Which is also $20,000.
Right.
Right. I would rather give to the guy, I'm sure we all would, right, that had $1 million, because even if it falls in value, right, you have $1 million. Forget the $20,000 in income, you have $1 million in investment.
That's right. Yep.
And I think the average person would be shocked. And by the way, I listen to some of your guys' shows on this, they're terrific. That it's a very Washington thing. Something had to be done. True. We agree. And they went through with these mortgage rules, and somebody in Washington typed them up, and they got some feedback. But, yeah, they're very W-2 specific, and God bless someone like Patrick that could actually buy the home with cash. What about everybody that can't?
Yep.
Let me ask you this, sir. Did you see the movie The Big Short or read the book, by any chance? Did you see The Big Short?
Pat, did you see The Big Short or read the book? By
I did. Chance? I read the book. I read the book as well. Yes.
Yep.
And what okay.
Do you, yep.
The one thing they do. Yeah, the one thing they do well in that, I think, is they go through the whole cycle of all of the whole mortgage process, right? From the person who should never have gotten a loan in the first place. There's a dancer at a gentleman's club who has seven mortgages, you know, in the movie, right? Which you shouldn't qualify for. There's the mortgage brokers who are terrible. So they illustrate it pretty well. But it's remarkable that when they wrote these rules, someone like Patrick can't get in. And remember, the entire problem was what? Bad mortgages in the system, and we're keeping good mortgages like Patrick's out.
That's right. And I appreciate you giving us the heads up on this, Kyle. Kyle Hopman of the Main Street Growth Project. And Pat, well, I'm glad you got lots of cash because you still got the house. But shame on the government for treating you this way. Thanks so much, Pat, by the way, for teaching a lot of young folks. Save your money. Put them in assets. Thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Good talking with you, Alan.
All right, guys.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we love to talk to you about sports, about culture, about the law. And this is a story where all three intersect, and we love 30-30 on ESPN, some of the best storytelling in America. And there was one story they did recently that we just had to dig into. The Duke University men's lacrosse team has always been one of the top D1 college lacrosse teams in this country. Outside of basketball, lacrosse is the most important sport played at the Harvard of the South in Durham, North Carolina. I went to University of Virginia, and lacrosse was really an important sport. I had never seen the sport before until then. In 2005, Duke suffered a heartbreaking loss to Johns Hopkins University at the lacrosse national championship game, but the squad had a deep bench, and it looked as if the following year would inevitably lead them right back to the national championship game. That is, until something unimaginable happened. On March 13th, 2006, here's how this world-renowned story began.
It was spring break. No one else on campus. It was a ghost town. A couple of us got together and all rode over to the house together. Rumors started circulating that, you know, someone had hired dancers to come.
40-some men. They hire two strippers to come. There are threatening remarks made about using a broom on one of the women.
When they stopped, there was a lot of confusion in the room. You know, guys thought that we might have been hustled when they said they were leaving. We paid $800 when they were there for 5 minutes. And naturally, guys got upset.
Crystal Mangum, she was behaving consistently with somebody who had just been attacked. She was not speaking coherently. She's asked, you know, have you been the victim of a sexual assault? She said yes.
She said yes. And then this happened 3 days later. Here's the Duke lacrosse team's co-captain at the time, Dave Evans.
I woke up from a nap to 10 police officers in my living room with a search warrant. I went through every part of it. It was scary.
And here's Dr. Houston Baker Jr. 10 days after the party. He's a black man who is a professor of English at Duke University. Also speaking is one of the many black students calling for instant justice.
So they've been tolerated. They felt entitled. They are a privileged group of white male athletes.
I can't believe my university has not spoken to this. I'm shocked and appalled that there are still varsity letters on these athletes.
And Crystal Mangum, the stripper, was African-American. The Duke lacrosse players were white. Some of them that were wealthy. Many of them from the Northeast, finding themselves in this small southern town. And the judgment was instantaneous against these guys. The world had almost instantly condemned them. This became an international story, not just a national story. And here's Dan Okrand, the former public editor of the New York Times.
It was white over black. It was male over female. It was rich over poor. It was educated over uneducated. My God, all the things that we know happen in the world coming together in one place. And, you know, journalists, they start to quiver with a thrill when something like this happens.
And good for Dan admitting that. That's a hard thing for a public editor to come to terms with, that his own breed, his own kind, have this kind of predetermined bias in a crime, a criminal case, where there should be none. Justice should be blind both ways. The media reports and the DA were so certain of the players' guilt that even the players' parents were struggling to believe their own kids. Here's Kevin Finnerty, the father of a player.
We're watching the DA on TV saying something happened. It was definitive in the way he was portraying it. And we were sitting down with Colin and saying, Colin, how could you be so sure nothing happened when we're seeing the DA on TV being definitive about what had happened? The hair was up on the back of our neck that this was serious.
Well, this is what a tough thing for a dad to even face down. The media, the students, and the faculty had their perfect villain. Privileged white males, no trial needed. The public wanted heads. Signs called for even their castration.
Unless we deal with this, nothing is going to change. It's going to happen next year, and it's going to happen next year, and it's going to happen 20 years from now, and I want it to stop happening.
Every day it was getting ramped up. It was like you were just waiting for something to explode, because it was like a little more lighter fluid on the fire, a little more lighter fluid, a little more lighter fluid.
The arrogance and the bravado that they could think that they were above the law, or they could think that this woman was below the respect of the human community.
Their behavior in a lot of regards is still really despicable.
The community consequences for this action, I guarantee you, will range far beyond the legal consequences that you will face.
Why are they still practicing? Why is the lacrosse program encouraging solidarity, encouraging team members to stand by each other, when that is exactly the opposite of what the district attorney, the exact opposite of what the police, and the exact opposite of what the administration claims they want to do?
People were parading around with posters with our face on it, straight out of the game program. They just blew it up and put it on a poster board, and we're walking around campus.
Newspapers, magazine covers, morning, noon, and night. It was every show. Full-screen TVs, 24/7.
Some faculty started circulating an ad that they wanted to put in the Duke Chronicle because it seemed important that faculty have something to say about what was going on.
To the students speaking individually and to the protesters making collective noise, thank you for not waiting.
We couldn't stop it. It was a runaway train that just kept running.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories for the Hour. The Duke lacrosse case looked at in really unique terms, recast by the crew at 30:30 at ESPN. And a more and really shameful performance by the administration of Duke University, the faculty, and so many other people, including the DA, when we come back here on Our American Stories. Imagine that, a faculty member telling kids at a major college, thank you for not waiting when an alleged crime has occurred. And by the way, the law school was nowhere to be found on this. The presumption of innocence just thrown out. And by the way, in the South, as you know, 40, 50 years ago, it was African Americans who were presumed guilty by all white mobs. What was To Kill a Mockingbird about? Or John Grisham's first story. And yet here they were, the social justice crowd, throwing justice to the wind because of the narrative. Rich white kids, poor black girl. Who cares? So much for injustice for all. The folks like the new Black Panther Party and Reverend Jesse Jackson, boy, they saw an opportunity and sprinted to Durham with, well, who knows what in their eyes, but at least dollar signs.
We come here today because justice has not been served.
That's right.
And we're here to assure justice. That's what we want. We want to hear and right now.
The history of Duke University is riddled in slavery, racist oppression, and racism against black people.
She's the one that's poor. They're the one that had the money. She's the one that has school children in college and struggling. They're the ones that are living a life of privilege.
And that was Jesse Jackson, and that's it. You know, you got privilege, you're guilty, you're poor, you're innocent. What a horrible thing to teach anybody in life. I mean, it's just, it's sad, actually. So the Duke administration, and this is number 10, Jesse, began to crumble and started throwing Hail Marys. They canceled the Duke lacrosse games against Georgetown as punishment for throwing the illicit party. Meanwhile, Crystal Mangum, the stripper who pressed charges against the team, had a DA assigned to her. His name, Mike Nifong. And Mike Nifong had more riding on this case than appeared. He was running for re-election.
I was sitting up in the balcony that they have there, and I spoke with five female students up there, and I just said, do you think this happened? And they said, yes, we do. And I said, well, why do you think it happened? And they said, because he told us. And I said, well, who's he? They pointed to Nifong.
A lot has been said about this case should go away. I hope that you will understand by the fact that I am here this morning that my presence here means that this case is not going away.
Sir, you are up for re-election, and during these times, what do you tell your constituents here in this county?
This is not about an election.
Yeah. As we'll learn soon, Nifong would come to eat those words. And not that there needed to be more wood added to the Duke lacrosse team's terrible bonfire, but then this leaked email happened.
Just minutes ago, we learned that one of the players has been suspended after writing a sick and twisted email.
6'6" star defenseman Ryan McFadden.
The person who does communications at this university came into my office. He came bounding through the door, and that's where I first read this email. You know, and I have to say, when I read it, I was sickened. I found it repulsive.
To whom it may concern, tomorrow night after tonight's show,
I decided to have some strippers over.
All are welcome. However, there will be no nudity.
I plan on killing them as soon as they walk in and proceeding to cut their skin off.
I was watching the news in my dorm room, and I just remember thinking, oh my God.
This clearly links the allegations to the lacrosse players, and they should be charged.
I'm going to use this. If I'm the lead investigator, this is big stuff for me to put some pressure on this guy, okay? Once one cracks, it's going to open the floodgates, I'm telling you. And I think that's going to happen within the next week, I can guarantee you.
Basically solidified everyone in America's mind that, you know, we were guilty, something had happened.
This whole thing is such a frightening example of a mass violent sociopathy gone out of control. This is less than an hour after this young lady reports being gang raped.
Just an awful email, you're asking? It didn't take more than a few minutes for the students to recognize that that email was actually, if you read it in context with the others, a joke.
I do remember being in the student newspaper office and somebody saying, this is from American Psycho.
It didn't take very long to recognize that quote. It was a very popular movie when it came out. Lots of jokes had been built from some of the quotes from that movie.
This was a private email sent to just the lacrosse team in a private group. It was a joke. It was bad judgment. bad timing in hindsight.
But not a crime. The players also got the American Psycho reference. One of the players responded with his own silly reference to the movie writing, "I'll bring the Phil Collins." It didn't matter, though, because the media did not report it, yet it was all that was needed to cause this.
In 3, 2, 1. 3 weeks after a woman accused several Duke lacrosse players of rape and sexual assault, head coach Mike Pressler has resigned. Pressler offered his resignation on Wednesday, and Duke's president accepted it. Also, the rest of the lacrosse season was canceled.
And there you had it. And that's when a whole bunch of media personalities started to really get involved. It was sort of this rush to judgment. And shockingly, the ACLU was nowhere to be found. And the ACLU defends all kinds of really tough cases, and they should. But other types of tough cases, they don't. And in the end, these guys luckily had the wealth and the privilege to buy legal defense. The players' attorneys went to speak with Mike Nifong, and this was the response they got.
We decided that it was time for someone to go talk to Nifong.
We tried to convince him that we had a story to tell ourselves. Mr. Nifong put his hands over his ears and said, "I don't want to hear it."
He literally put his hands over his ears.
"I am not going to allow Durham's view and the mind of the world to be a bunch of lacrosse players from Duke raping a black girl in Durham."
He had been out in public promising to voters that he would not drop the case. So he couldn't afford to hear exculpatory evidence.
"The reason that you should vote for me for district attorney is because I would rather do the right thing than win this election."
And by the way, this has to give any of you pause who are listening. If there's a highly charged case and you see a DA on a courthouse step with a gaggle of news reporters and gangs, start getting scared for your own family and your own rights. Because this is where responsible DAs, and I've seen them all over this country, handle tough cases and say, "Look, we're going to take it where the facts lead, and we're going to take our time. And if you don't like it, tough." And not acquiescing, as we've seen in a lot of these very public trials in the last few years, where DAs have felt the pressure from the crowds to run to judgment. Again, what was our struggle in the South all about? It was to get due process and justice for everybody, all races, creeds, and colors. And by the way, the poor have it much tougher than the wealthy in this country. If these guys, these Duke lacrosse players, had no money, they'd be in the slammer right now. And there are a lot of African Americans who are in the slammer, and poor white people, for that matter, who simply can't afford the legal representation. And groups like the Innocence Project do titanic work in this space, doing DNA analysis, reviewing old cases, looking at habeas petitions of jailhouse lawyers who teach themselves to appeal their own cases because they're convinced and know they didn't do a crime. But my goodness, where was everybody with these Duke players? The cowardice in this particular case, well, I'm a law guy myself and went to a great law school. It stunned us. It stunned us. And thanks for the hard work here. When we come back off the break, we're going to go in even deeper. And you won't believe what happens here in this case. And the reporting here you're hearing from is from sports. Well, you know, the world of sports, that is. And from ESPN, of all places. And their 30-30s, if you haven't seen them, catch them. They're generally on ESPN2, ESPN3. They rotate around. Go on the grid. The Archie Manning one is just, it'll kill you how good it is. Learning about Archie's life. And we broadcast to you from Oxford, Mississippi. And you'll learn things about that man that you never knew before. And you're going to learn a lot more about Mike Nifong, the district attorney in Durham. And it's going to sicken you. Stick around. It's a great story. And it gets worse before it gets better. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the Duke lacrosse case. 30-30 on ESPN. They did a magnificent job. Catch it on a rerun. We're giving you the best parts of it here tonight. 28 days after that party, the DNA test results of every Duke lacrosse player at that party were released. Here's the player's attorneys.
We received this afternoon the results of the SBI DNA examination. No DNA material from any young man tested was present on the body of this complaining woman.
The prosecutor sought the court's permission to have this report, saying that he wanted this report to be able to show that people were innocent. Well, this report shows that they're innocent.
We hope now with this long-awaited test and these results that Mr. Nifong will announce that he is not going to pursue this case further.
Seems like a closed case, right? No DNA? It was not enough. In fact, nothing was enough. Those kids were white, rich, male, and privileged, and therefore guilty. Here's Jesse Jackson reacting to that DNA report.
There are many ways DNA could not have played into this. What we do know is that something took place.
Wow, that's a switch. Now DNA doesn't matter. And something happened. We just don't know what. It's 30 days after the party. The DNA results from the state weren't going to move Nifong and Sergeant Gottlieb, another villain in this story. They brought in Crystal Mangum to move the case forward.
Mark Gottlieb and Nifong, they put together photos. It was only the lacrosse players.
Basically, they told her at the beginning, these are all the white players on the Duke lacrosse team. Pick three.
Mike Nifong was not going to walk away from this case until he had charged three people.
And by the way, lineups are the way that, in fact, the chief way that the Innocence Project does its work, because there are legitimate lineups and there are illegitimate. One of the key things prosecutors can do is imply or intimate that one of the defendants in the room did the crime. And then what will inevitably happen is the person who's looking in that booth will pick the person that most looked like the person that did the crime. And then when they go to court, they actually identify that person. How do they remember him? From the crime? No, from the lineup. And by the way, it's why the FBI's protocol for lineups is one person at a time. One person at a time. And then they have to say that's the person, not comparative. And the FBI has begged states, counties, local to do it that way, and then you won't have these crummy verdicts. But of course, prosecutors want convictions, so they don't care. And they continue to do these gang lineups. And I know this only because I worked in a prosecutor's office and a public defender's office in my 2 years in law school. And it infuriated me what the prosecutors did in these regards. They were just looking for guilt. So Nifong doubled down on the DNA evidence. This time, he went behind the back of the state lab and had a private lab that he was working intimately with do another round of testing.
So comments start shifting and activity starts shifting back again toward DNA evidence. He hired DNA Security, which was a private lab, to do additional testing to see if they could identify DNA that the state crime lab had not found. Effectively going behind the state crime lab, doing the same kinds of tests on the same kinds of evidence. Working behind the scenes to figure out ways to develop evidence. It happened graduation weekend and the day after Mother's Day.
A preliminary finding shows there is a partial match of DNA on a fingernail found in a bathroom trash can. It's the DNA of a third suspect.
It's now 63 days after the party, and Nifong's second attempt at the DNA testing struck gold. His third suspect was co-captain Dave Evans. Dave immediately held a press conference. The female voice you will hear is Mike Nifong's campaign manager at the time, Jackie Brown.
I want to thank you all for letting me speak to you today. My name is Dave Evans, and I'm a captain of the Duke University men's lacrosse team. I have to say that I'm very relieved to be the person who can come out and speak on behalf of my family and my team.
I was sitting at home, and a friend called and said, "You got to turn the TV on.
and he started talking, looking straight into the eye of everybody in Durham.
First, I want to say that I'm absolutely innocent of all the charges that have been brought against me today, that Reed Seligman and Colin Fernie are innocent of all the charges that were brought against them. When the police first came to my home, I fully cooperated and have continued to try to cooperate with them. When they entered in and started to read the search warrant, my roommates and I helped them find evidence for almost an hour and told them that if they had any questions, we would gladly answer them to show that nothing happened that night. I'd like to say thank you to my friends and family, my coach, and members of the community who have stood by us through everything from the initial weeks to now. Their support has given me the strength to come through this. But the thing that gives me the most strength is knowing that I have the truth behind me and it will not faze me. As for my teammates, I love you all. The honor of being voted captain of all of you, the 46 best guys you could ever meet, it's been the greatest honor of my life. I am innocent. Reed Seligman is innocent. Colin Finnerty is innocent. Every member of the Duke University lacrosse team is innocent. You have all been told some fantastic lies.
I knew in my heart that day that all of this was a lie.
So Nifong's people knew it too. And then what do you do about it? Because he's just led you down the road. Unfortunately, Nifong was not alone in his excessively aggressive prosecution. Those cameras were everywhere, folks. Sergeant Mark Gottlieb of the Durham PD was scheming damn hard to finger this case on the Duke lacrosse boys, too.
The verbal description that Crystal gave to the police of her assailants, it was stocky, it was dark hair, it was muscular, it was short. No one would confuse her verbal description of her assailants with Colin. It was later that year that Sergeant Gottlieb released his notes. 20, 30, 40 pages of notes that he had accumulated and finally written up his report. His version of her description of her assailants fit Colin and each of the boys to a T.
How about that? And again, this is why we have criminal law in this country and why we got a few amendments dedicated to this. The 4th, the 5th, and the 6th Amendments. 3 out of the 10 are there because of the powers of the state to do just this kind of thing. And again, the power of the state in the South to do this to African Americans only 30 or 40 years before. And in the end, that's why we can, and we've heard it over and over again, law and order. You have the right to an attorney. You have the right not to incriminate yourself. These things matter. You're innocent. Your presumption of innocence, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. We need to get 12 jurors, not 11, not 10, not 9, because we do not want to imprison people for things they did not do. And this, frankly, is what the revolution was fought over. The Star Chamber. Searchless, warrantless searches. And this is what our country's founded on. This is not a liberal position, and this is not a conservative position. In fact, liberals should have been leading the charge on this, and particularly the ACLU. And they didn't. When we come back, you're going to hear the rest of and the end of this story and the triumph of these boys. My goodness, did I almost teared up listening to Dave Evans. What a stud. What a star. Fearless. I'll never forget seeing that presser. And I think so many of us were thinking, my goodness, he's not blinking. And that took some real guts. When we come back, the great work of ESPN 3030, the Duke lacrosse case, here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we give you every kind of story here. Funny ones, sad ones, love and death, the arts, and sometimes the law, the culture, race, all intersect, and they did in the Duke lacrosse case. And we pick up where the three boys and their attorneys, and luckily they could afford them, were working hard to prove their innocence.
One of the first things we did is we asked for cell phone records. And we began by asking for Ms. Mangum's cell phone records. Between 11:11 and 11:39, she made 5 telephone calls. So what we know is that she's not being gang raped while she's on the telephone. Mr. Bissy remembers quite specifically noting it was midnight the first time the two women went into the house. Reed's cell phone records, he's on his cell phone from 12:06 to 12:14.
Reed walked up to me, said, "Hey, let's get out of here." And so we hopped in a cab. Went to the bank to get cash out.
He was literally on video a mile away from the site at the time of the alleged assault.
We see Colin is making a call at 12:22. He makes another call at 12:24. And then Dave Evans makes a call at 11:29, and then from 12:34 to 12:50. At 12:26, Ms. Mangum makes a cell phone call. Does she call 911? Does she call her home telephone number? "Help, come get me. Something terrible's happened." She actually calls the voicemail box at her escort service. And then at 12:46, Reed re-enters his dorm room, which leaves a computer footprint of when he re-entered. "Find me 20 minutes. Find me 10 minutes. Find me where these three young men had the opportunity to commit this crime." It's not there.
It's not there. And again, you don't have the lawyers to run this down. Good luck. Good luck. And here's the best part of the story. There's that new DNA test that Nifong concocted with his buddies. And what to do next? And here's where the very young and highly talented Duke lacrosse player slash attorney, because he played one here, Brad Bannon, discussing what happened next when trying to deal with the evidence from this new DNA test.
"I was really curious to know, how could our state crime lab and this private lab come up with two pretty fundamentally different conclusions about this fingernail thing while using the same kind of DNA testing?"
"We demanded Mr. Nifong give us the underlying data. Finally, he dumped 2,500 pages of very highly technical DNA evidence."
"I asked some attorneys that we were consulting with, if you were going to try to learn about DNA, where would you go? And they recommended a book on Amazon.com. As I was reading that book, I started trying to figure out what all of this data that we had been handed was.
I walked in here in the morning and Brad was in the conference room. And I said, 'What are you doing?' He said, 'Well, we've got all this DNA and I've ordered this book on DNA and I'm going to go through it and figure out what it is.' I said, 'Knock yourself out.' I left that evening at 7 o'clock and he was still in there. I got back the next morning at 8, he was still in there. I left at 7, he was still in there. I got back Wednesday, he was still in there. I left Wednesday, he was still in there. Thursday, the same thing happened."
It was all of the DNA specimens from the Duke lacrosse team. So then I figured, well, what all am I looking at here that does not match them?
"Every red number you see in this chart is unidentified male DNA that was found in her, on her, or on her clothing. Somewhere between 7 and 11 different males.
Multiple male DNA was found that totally excluded
the Duke lacrosse players, including the three indicted players, but had not been reported. This was not just an inadvertent oversight, but in fact was the product of decision-making at some level, either at the lab or the DA's office.
And so imagine this, folks. It took a student who knew nothing about DNA, who knew a lot about the law, though young, and he taught himself how to evaluate this fraudulent DNA report. Day in, day out, he kept at it, and he made this discovery. The day of the trial arrived, and this is all pre-trial hearings, and that's what makes or breaks trials, folks. It's the evidentiary hearings. Good evidence, bad evidence, in or out. End of case, if you've got the right lawyers. And Nifong didn't disappoint. His first witness was Brian Meehan, the lab director from the private DNA security firm. Here's how it went down.
It was a brilliant move. We hadn't come prepared to cross-examine a DNA expert about DNA. We had no idea he was going to be there.
All of us huddled up. And the consensus among most was to ask for more time.
Joe said, we don't have a choice. We've got to move forward. If we don't, we're going to get killed.
Joe's position was, we're going to question him today. And by we, I mean you, Brad.
Brad was obviously terrified because it's tough enough cross-examining a DNA expert without preparation. But when the entire media in the country is going to be covering it, you don't want to fall on your face.
I said to Joe, I don't want to do that. I can't do that.
That's when I said to him, Brad, I've been telling you for 10 years that you're an exceptional lawyer. You are different. You are a great lawyer. And you are prepared to do this. You do know it. You don't need any more time. You can do it, and you can do it great, and you will do it great.
And I felt like I was in a sports movie.
I mean, this is like wanting the ball at the end of the game. You know, if you're going to be a great lawyer, you've got to want the ball at the end of the game. And so it was basically agreed. We were going to do it by the seat of our pants.
And this young lawyer, he steps up, and here's the dramatic conclusion to this story.
Brad pulled out a couple of the DNA test results and threw them in front of him.
I basically proceeded to then move through each one of the electropherogram charts, one by one.
That would be page 5.
It became fairly clear about 10 or 15 minutes into it that the expert realized that Brad knew what the hell he was talking about.
I said, now I want you to go to that chart, and I want you to tell me, is there multiple male DNA on there?
Yes, there are.
Does it not match anybody on the Duke lacrosse team?
That's correct.
Was it not included in your report?
Yeah, so...
Ate Meehan alive.
Dr. Meehan was confirming over and over again that as he made these discoveries, he reported them to Mike Nifong.
Yeah, I didn't document the exact time of those discussions.
Next question.
Judge Smith is staring at Nifong as if he could bear his eyes through him. And Nifong is sitting at the prosecutor's table with his head down in his elbows.
Casey Johnson was sitting behind us. And he slipped me a piece of paper. And all it said was, oh my God, he knew this before he indicted them.
Brad came up to me and said, I'm done. I can't go any farther. And I said, don't worry. I think I can take it from here.
Cooney phrases the perfect question. He asked Meehan, have you entered into an intentional agreement with a representative of the state of North Carolina, Nifong, not to report all of the test results?
There's only one answer to this question, and that answer being yes, because we did not report the reference profiles of those specimens, and we did talk about not reporting those.
Literally, applause erupted in the courtroom.
The judge looked stunned.
I felt like my head had exploded.
All of a sudden, a central truth came out from the witness that Mr. Nifong himself brought.
It all just like fit together that, oh my God, they had to work at this. Like, they had to work to get to the place where these kids are right now.
It was a remarkable moment when he finally said what we knew had happened. The case had imploded at that point.
And the witness for the prosecution became the witness for the defense. Crystal Magnum paid no penalty for the suffering she caused based on her lies. In 2013, she was found guilty of second-degree murder for her boyfriend and was sentenced to 14 to 18 years in prison. The media didn't cover that. Sergeant Mark Gottlieb committed suicide in 2014. The media didn't cover that. Mike Nifong was disbarred and served a 24-hour prison sentence. All three players from Duke reached an out-of-court settlement. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Great job on this, Greg.